Thank you for coming to the MFA reading. All the parents who are here and families, it's fascinating to see you. As I think I always say, it's like, oh, everything now makes sense. And of course, classmates and students of our students and my fellow faculty. Tonight we come together to celebrate a reading by our 8 graduating writers from the MFA program. Patrick Nuttall, whom I've known since he was in high school and whose unassuming intelligence lights up the workshop. Joanna St. Germain, whom I count on to look out for her classmates. Cynthian Ko, who only seems quiet, but is a real force within the program and well beyond. Mary Casey, whose wide-ranging reading base and plethora of family stories enlivened a literature class she took with me. Morgan Lipkin, who was my true companion when we worked with senior citizens, unforgettable experience, and whose attentiveness was a model for everyone when we worked with middle schoolers. Sadie Shore Parks, who is the MFA program's number one advocate, volunteering to talk with 101 and 102 students about creative writing classes. Jessica Guzman, on whose wit and discretion and quick smile I depend. And John Bryant, whose gentle presence recalls us always to our best selves. I normally don't want to do that, to say something little about each person. It's too much pressure to say something equal and make everything right. But this year, with this group, all of whom I have taught, I did want to speak of each one of them briefly and fondly. And I want to congratulate them on behalf of my colleagues, Elissa High, Ethel Morgan Smith, Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Mark Brazitis, and Glenn Taylor. We're proud of all you've accomplished. The MFA is an interesting degree. Often we worry over it. We wonder about its utility. We know that as a credential, it is just a beginning. And yet the time is a gift, we say, in the experience of the community also. And beyond all that, the act of writing, of making our lives available to others, is no small thing. We make literature for the same reason we read it and reread it. It's meaningful to do so. Time well spent. A pleasure, a heartache, a moment of humor or recognition, all of these are worthwhile. Patrick, Joanna, Cynthian, Mary, Morgan, Sadie, Jessica, and John, thank you for sharing your lives with us. We hope that you too feel that your time in the MFA program has been time well spent, a good beginning. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first reader. We're going to go, obviously, in the order listed there. Jim Harms was Patrick Nuttall's thesis director, but Jim can't be here tonight, so he wrote this for me, which I wish I had printed out in larger print type, whatever. We'll see if I can do a good job. Thesis directors will introduce their advisees, and then the writer will come up, and we'll do the hooding, which is always odd. And then the writer will read while tugging at the hood. So, Patrick. There is a moment in his wonderful thesis, A Census of Ghosts, where Patrick Nuttall pauses to assess the larger project of poetry. After watching a car try and fail twice to climb an icy hill, the speaker of his poems remembers a similar scene from the day before and then imagines a scene from 4 years before that, a scene he knows only secondhand. This, he says, is how memory stills. That notion that memory in the service of imagination can stop time momentarily is central to the quietly epiphanic poetry Patrick writes. His ambitions are huge. To slip free of the linear rules of history, to blend memory and the lived moment into what Wordsworth called a spot of time. That he succeeds in these ambitions without raising his voice or insisting on a specific understanding speaks to his understated power as a poet. Please welcome Patrick Nuttall.
Well, I'm not going to be an Oscar case and thank too many people, but for those of you who can make it, thank you, and even those who couldn't, glad you're all here. Okay, so I'm going to read 3 poems. My poems tend to edge on long, so hopefully nobody falls asleep. But, yeah. On their 3rd attempt at conversion, the Mormons bring a woman. Elder Esperanza and Rudd, handsome black slacks, sweat-free at 90 degrees, laughed when appropriate. And if I had found those golden plates, I would have melted them down, paid my debts, bought more bill, beer. Instead, I say, I don't know. In my green recliner, rubric and soft, she flattens her dress. She says, skydive, skywise. I never told my granny until after Christmas I jumped. And I forget the light breath of Rudd beside me and imagine myself single, my hand on her thigh, her lips on my neck, green underwear matching her dress. They all smile and ask which kingdom I can call my own. I say, I'll take the second one, with the non-believers that weren't horrible. They laugh and I think, none. I notice the soiled mat near the door, the empty space for my fiancé shoes, and my naked wrist, a watch I haven't worn in years. Esperanza whistles, Rudd stands to pace. I offer them water, hope they stay. Esperanza places his hand on my shoulder and takes my telephone number, his notepad, pale blue like sky, and the sound Moroni made, I assume, before promoted to angelhood, to sainthood. Realizing immortal means forever, or close enough to it you can never quite escape. I didn't lie, she says. I screamed the whole way down. Sticks her tongue out, the floral collar dipping as she readjusts. Her bra as white as her faith, she might say, or somebody in a movie. So this is going to be my second poem. This is actually the one that Jim might have quoted, perhaps. And it's about my niece, which is a running theme throughout my thesis. On what would have been your 9th birthday. Every year I imagine this is the last day of winter. A car tries up the hill twice. Yesterday even, the tow truck slid into the snow and waited hours. After 4 years, my sister tells me how you died. In a hospital on a machine that made noise like a robot. The two of you were alone until a nurse turned everything off. This is how memory stills. I remember, before the call, I was on a bus back to Kalamazoo, thinking about the hands of a woman at work I wanted to have sex with. A Mennonite couple argued at the front of the bus in soft words. The woman I love now never knew you. I forget this often. At the back of the pantry, 3 pouches of loose leaf tea, Earl Grey, mulberry, orchard vanilla, a box of cake, instant cocoa, a paper cup. Okay, this is my last poem. Not ever, just here. And it's called On the Failings of Meditation. We are naked, and you are snoring. I try to sleep like this, to hold you, but not wake you. 1 foot out of the blanket to keep cool. This is the darkness of our generation. A phone pulses green on the ceiling, a blue light on your neck. All I can do is count. How long until I give up on rested and settle on functional? On the lawn, a man yells, Martha. His voice catches on a sob, catches on, I still love you, or don't leave me here. Under him, the grass crumpled by bare feet, until tomorrow when the mower man mows. If he looks up, there will be stars, or the illusion of them. In the dark, on high rises, late night men and old white light sighing, while rats make droppings on the tiles above their heads. If I go outside, he will be gone, except his paw prints of a season too stubborn to die. I make my breath vanish, and, although I can feel you, for a moment, you are alone. Thank you.
Joanna St. Germain writes about people on the edge. On the edge of poverty, on the edge of mental stability, on the edge of this world and the next, on the edge in the case of her character Elijah, of the fine border between civilization and wilderness. People on the edge, or edges, as Freud would tell us, if you were standing back there with the punch, sneaking a cigar, can teach us a great deal about ourselves, those of us, that is, who inhabit a territory away from the edges, closer to the middle. But who am I kidding? We are all on the edge in our own ways, and Joanna's insightful and beautiful prose takes us there and shows us ourselves. Please welcome the wonderful writer, Joanna St. Germain.
I assume. I'm going to awkwardly tug at this and my hair and my clothes because I feel awkward all the time, and that's what I do. Okay. And then I make jokes about it. And it doesn't make it less awkward, but I always hope. Okay, so my thesis is called Lost Nation, and I don't know, are we supposed to thank people? It's so silly, but I mean, obviously, without Mark and Glenn and Rosemary, who is not here today, and also my friends in the program, right? I mean, I wouldn't have written this without you guys, so I'm just going to read the first chapter, and it's only 2 pages and a little bit more, so it's short. You're welcome. The sun rose over the jutting mountain to the east of Lost Nation, Maine. Its light spread across rolling hills and shabby houses. During the long months of winter, it sat wan and cold in the sky, pale and anemic as the residents below. It pulsed with hazy heat during the summer weeks, melting the sky. It was at its best during the in-between months, spring and fall, when it winked benevolent at the residents of the town below while the breeze tugged playfully at their clothes. Nobody below thought much about the sun, except to comment when it shone too bright or not bright enough, to complain it wasn't throwing enough heat or else too much. They were a people of unquestioning routine. They went to work or not as they'd grown accustomed. They drew a check or not. They drank coffee every morning and fell asleep early. Their homes were 3 decades old or older, built when the paper industry was still going strong. The houses stood humiliated with peeling paint and dreaded the rise of the sun that was so unforgiving as to shed light on their decline. The yards contained children's toys once bright, now bleached sad by the sun and largely abandoned by the kids who'd grown up. Or else the yards were littered with rusted car frames and tires. Or else the yards were hideously overgrown, nature trying to reclaim the mess and people too apathetic to fight it. Teenagers from the surrounding town swarmed the broke-down factory for lack of better entertainment. The glass broke almost of its own accord, burst inward from its frames at the rocks they threw. Graffitied expressions of the basest parts of themselves covered the walls inside. They smoked bad weed when they could get it and sank deep inside the apathy that seemed natural and inevitable to these parts. When there was no grass to be had, hard liquor was passed from mouth to mouth, and the urge to destroy their lives rose like dragons from the deep, unknown parts of themselves, and they destroyed what surrounded them instead, and sometimes each other. The parents and grandparents of the teenagers watched TV. They scraped ice from their cars in the winter when they had to leave the house, and when they didn't, they napped on their couches while crime shows flickered blue across their slack faces. Upon waking, they padded to their kitchens barefoot and dazed and scrambled an egg. And if they happened to glance out the window, it was not to marvel at the heaps of snow the sky had set down as a gift, but to think with dread of the moment when they couldn't put off the shoveling. But the children knew. The children woke from their beds every morning and dressed in a hurry to greet the sun again and the trees. The town was mostly forest, just kind of interrupted by the main street and the residential streets radiating it out. The kids knew. The trees were omnipresent. The trees that grew thick and close with remembering what the people forgot so easily. It was the trees that dominated the landscape, and yet the people of the town had long since ceased to see them unless one fell on or near their homes. The children went to the woods and felt the ancient roots running under the soil they ran across barefoot 3 seasons of the year. The forest opened itself to them. To them, the trees were as old as time itself, had always been and would always be. As they ducked under half-fallen trees, clambered over boulders, and splashed through puddles, they imagined all the things the trees had stood witness to and became drunk on the mystery of the world, on all that was unknowable. They felt their toes sink into the forest carpet of dead and rotting leaves, straight down into the dirt, and imagined themselves taking root and growing as still and huge and immortal as they perceived the trees to be. And they played pioneering games, and they returned when dark fell to the shabby homes where the parents sat, exhausted, from the weight of existing, waiting at the dinner table to serve them macaroni and cheese.
At the start of the graduate poetry workshop, I always ask each poet to tell me about his or her background and influences. This year's questions included, do you prefer Whitman or Dickinson? Why? Sin Tien Co responded, Dickinson. She leaves you thinking for a long time. Which is just a lovely sum up of Dickinson, right? The same might be said of Sin Tien's deft and deceptively clear poems. Her thesis, I Haven't Once Forgotten, is about leaving home, returning, heading out again, about relief or the lack of relief, about what is colloquial and what could never be, about faith, now and in the future. She sets each line down. The care is apparent. A small ceremony, but a ceremony nonetheless. The emotion may be grief or just wonder. She leaves us thinking for a long time. Please welcome Sin Tien Co.
Oh, you made it. Thank you to Marianne, Jim, Julia, and my fellow MFAs, and the English department professors and grad students, to my family, and to a lot of Singaporeans who are not here. Thanks to all of you for coming out tonight and supporting us. I'm going to read four poems from my thesis. It's Why I Love You. 36 minutes to closing time. I made devotion happen on a library scanner. Then I shut the lid and I was tired. Hadn't I said I was good at this? I love it when you do math, a friend once said. It's so charming. This whole week, nobody had honked at me and I stayed in my lane. But there had to be something about the rhododendrons that my driving instructor pointed out beside the road. You're such a hater, another friend had said. I hate it, no, more negativity, etc. It's why I love you, SDK. Outside the library, another rhododendron bush was at it. The pink was too beautiful to look at. Practice. This kitchen is not the best. Neither are my hands nor my sense of timing. What I can do is follow instructions and check the clock again and again. What is it that makes me think I'm feeling like a long skirt today? And then the cats below the balcony get into a fight, which is over by the time I come out and look down. All I see is the instigator, black and white, walking away while looking at me, but I haven't once forgotten that my cookies in the oven are turning into beautiful shapes. Supplying. The air got warm for only a bit. I was really just taking myself outside. The store was only a destination, while the pavement's ice was the reminder. My shelves had been emptied so quickly, and I had cooked so much for others. But I had no struggle to speak of. And there was nothing wrong with me. There had been so much wind, and the chime on my balcony had clung onto its nail beautifully. Run upon. Before spring even began, I was wet sand, creasing and airing itself. But every raised scar was quartz to be scraped, each knocker red, counting time off. The candle stopped the air but ended nothing. Neither could a dream of an Itzara's nectar. Thank you.
Mary Casey's characters aren't romantics. At least, I don't think they are. I mean, what kind of romantic suggests a threesome not long after meeting the woman of his dreams? Or maybe I missed that life lesson, and it's the new romantic math. Romance being 33% better with one more. On the other hand, Trent, of her wonderful novel, Trent and Posey, he of the mathematical proposition, is sweet and thoughtful, kind and dutiful, and even a rescuer of sorts after a startling snake bite. And it's Posey, after all, who is keen with a cold shoulder, a mixed message, and an I'm an artist and your kisses will have to wait attitude. But then again, there is in Mary's novel, Italy. Will even Posey resist the romance of Italy? Here to explain love and all other mysteries of the universe, the fabulous writer, Mary Casey.
I would like to thank my friends, my family, the entire state of West Virginia, all my teachers, and flowers. Okay, I'm going to read to you a section. This is when Trenton Posey, my character's been going out for a little while. It was a Saturday afternoon. Trent played show and tell with Posey in his apartment after they had sex. He was in boxers. She was naked. Trent pulled a large box from the closet and produced from it the watercolors his grandmother had painted. "Would you like to see my gram's paintings?" Posey smiled and leaned across the bed to see. He pulled tissue paper from the first painting in the stack. "This one is of Young's Jersey Dairy. It's like an ice cream parlor, but way more, almost an amusement park. There's a petting zoo and mini golf and a playground slide that's like 3 stories tall. It's outside of Dayton." The painting was a nighttime landscape, but the storefront at the dairy was all lit up. Families were painted in a long line to the store, in the light parking lot with their cars, around picnic tables holding waffle cones and styrofoam cups. Stars were painted in no particular constellations. The barn roofs were silhouettes in low contrast to the deep blue of the sky. "This is really fantastic," Posey said. "It's quaint," Trent modified. "No. Well, it's not in conversation with the avant-garde, no, not really, not the community of curtain or recent art, but it's far from provincial." Posey traced with her fingers the lines of yellow-white that poured from the halogen streetlight above the parking lot down to the gray-white lines of the fences that splayed out on either side of the dairy. "This triangle shape, these orthogonal lines, that's classic, that's artistic." Trent nodded. The next was a watercolor portrait of a very old woman in what appeared to be a vacation house living room, all botanical print and tropical plants in shades of coral and lime and beige. "This is my great-grandmother." "Is she still living?" Posey asked. "No, my grandmother painted this right before Grammy died, maybe 15 years ago. This is very artistic, too." "You're being kind," Trent said. "It's weird." "I'm being no such thing. I am being right. Look at these palm fronds. They're everywhere." Posey pointed to the fans of palms in the print of the old woman's dress, in the print of the upholstery of the chair on which she sat, in the corner of the room growing from a planter, in the print of the curtains, in the land beyond the curtains. "Do you know what palm fronds are?" "Yes." "So you know their original beauty. When Odysseus saw beauty that was unprecedented, it reminded him of a palm frond. Matisse, for Christ's sake." "The precedent for unprecedented beauty, Trent, they're so important." "So does that make any sketch of a Florida home artistically important?" Trent asked. "I should hope so," Posey argued. "But this one certainly is, at the very least. I also love that your great-grandmother's face is the color of Gravlax. That's got to be worth something, too." And so it went on. Trent began to trust that his grandmother's paintings were important and that Posey would know why. They were. She did. When they were finished, when Posey had been allowed to evaluate 14 watercolor paintings, when she had started searching for her clothes on the floor of Trent's bedroom, Trent carefully gathered the paintings and started to wrap each in special tissue paper and slip them back into the acid-free box. "Thanks, Posey," Trent said. "This was nice." The sentiment made her look up. She noticed what he was doing. "What are you doing to that art?" Posey asked, indignant. Trent gave a defensive shrug. "Why aren't those going on the wall?" "I keep them in this box." Posey sank to the bed. She furrowed her brow. "I assumed you'd just gotten them. You have no art on your walls. I didn't think you'd been keeping those hidden away." "You saw me take them out of the box, Posey." "I know. I thought you'd only put them there today. I don't know, for a post-coital art surprise or for me or something." Her voice raised at the end of the sentence, questioning the notion of a post-coital art surprise. Questioning a lot. "This is silly, isn't it?" She pouted meekly. Trent took a step towards her, and quickly, Posey straightened her posture and corrected herself. "Obviously, you're a fool to hide those. Are you against displaying a love of life? Because the walls in this house seem to be making a rather Trappist statement, and you know how I feel about Trappist. It's terribly austere. Really, we ought to buy some frames for you, for those." He stepped close to her. He kissed her on the top of the head. We can do that now if you want. He rubbed her back. She wrapped her arms around his waist and looked up at him. That would be nice. She kissed his stomach. It simply has to be done today. That's how they spent their afternoon. Trent measured each painting and listed the dimensions with brief descriptions. 22 by 30, Young Sterry. 16 by 20, Aunt Muriel. 11 by 15, Beagle Puppies. 22 by 30, Tulips in Field. 15 by 11, Tulips on Casket. 22 by 30, Grammy and Palm Fronds. 11 by 15, Church in Yellow Springs, etc. Trent and Posey scavenged what frames would suit their needs from thrift stores. They found others that fit the bill at an indoor flea market. They found the remaining two, cheap and plastic, at a national chain store, along with a kit containing brass picture hangers, brads, sawtooth hooks, picture wire, and screw eyes. Trent let Posey choose where the paintings went and even rearranged the placement of two chairs. It was beautiful.
Morgan, I think you missed my introduction in which I talked about our senior citizen time.
Yeah, exactly.
Mystery, dark silences, dense descriptions, these are qualities Morgan Lipkin responds to in the work of other poets. Morgan's work, too, is a secret note to the self. We're reading over her shoulder, we're listening in, to mother and father, grandmother and grandfather, two oceans. You write your life, Eudora Welty tells us, and you discover the sequence in experience is when a train makes a curve and the mountain of meaning that was always there comes into view. Morgan's work works like that, as she knows, trusting greater and greater mysteries, taking us with her as she goes. Please welcome Morgan Lipkin.
Hi. I'm not seeing many of you until now, so thanks for seeing me now. I've just returned to the planet. Okay. It's supposed to be sweet for my sister. I strike the box of matches, and Our Lady of Grace, with her hands palmer surface up, keeps my company. A bird cries, suddenly, suddenly, suddenly. You and I, we want to trundle beds, pink canopies with ruffles overhead each night. We whispered about our parents, played speed, the neighbors directly behind us, and why did that stepfather keep Playboys in open sight? Our feet forward against our jellies, the road, heat blurs, and the ice cream man, his orange truck. He was silent and in a white button-up. We knew a dollar for posh and baby spice lollipops, plexiglass thudding with a waiting June bug. We stopped to gather petals for rose water, a lady's mist. A lizard green up the neighbor's fence, working people. Are the people living under the overpass ever welcomed? We're the good girls putting our trash in the bin and picking up after others. White, beige, ivory, gray, but one house is painted blue with a golden Japanese pagoda house wind chime, and grace blows its sound as smooth as rains off its many roofs. If the grass was sweet in the morning, we heated up a can of chili, made 5-minute rice, mild cheddar, packed in a Tupperware, out for a picnic. Paper towels forgotten at home. The park rimmed with pines, and it's past one, so the little kids were down for naps. I've let the basil become too dry and water them in a hurry. Behind the door, only one spider left of the three, and she is lanky, shiny black. her web not visible in this light. Should I move her outside? Before bed, you'd tumble and somersault in your bunk, and I said, watch your head. Your snores faint. Today, I might walk as long as a camel, and with less water. But why didn't Joseph invite Mary's sister along? 17 pencils sharpened, a long candle, and one fake flower taped to a pin. I'm at the desk again. Kinetic, I told you, this is how we share energy. We're kinetic, you said. We dress ourselves alike, tie upright knots before going to school on a foggy morning. Brush your teeth every day and always flip your hair over your head after brushing. My heart green like our sneakers. Okay, and this one I thought, since some of y'all are moving right now, some of you aren't, moving Nana back to California after 24 years. I've been in over my head, dust naturally. The weather stays steady, more like air above the morning river. It's her turn. Fair enough. Mother painted those plates, and Mother had rollers in her hair and her graceful cigarette. That's my mother's mother, Mother. I remember by the slivers of a moth's wing. It is as if joy is something we found under 20 years of water bills. My first memory of her isn't the first to happen. Sleep and let me appease others. The blinds clank together from the fan, and in the neighbor's yard, turtles' eggs nest. For the next hour, car doors will close. If you love God, Mother, there is an ocean surrounding both sides of this country. And then I brought one more, but usually I don't read that one, but I feel like I should. Okay. This is one that's like a thing to do. Okay. Where Fathers Come From. This is after James Tate's Where Babies Come From, but it's not the same tone. In the middle of the Pacific, on a forgotten World War II island, fathers play jacks, run with belly heat, and they never learn how to tie their shoelaces. Some fathers take younger ones, hog-tie them with laundry rope, and honeyed hands full, glazing their smoothing faces, all under a loquat. The chase is for the wild dogs, but the fathers run too. Some fathers, with scraped elbows and knees, cry a little each night. They've lost mother's lipstick smell and their slumber prayers. A few die, decompose in those ferns. A few fathers build a raft mid-April, sloppy bamboo and palm leaves spread out sideways. They push toward empty shores and black highways divided by bright lines. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for everything.
In her thesis about faith, Sadie remembers herself as a difficult baby, strangely judgmental, even before she learned to talk. By her own account, with her baby-sized rapier, she skewered pretty much anybody who, and everything that had the misfortune to fall under her fell gaze. So we're lucky that Sadie arrived at WVU as an adult. She brought with her a generous energy to the classroom and to the page. Smart, cultured, confident, Sadie favored the mask of comedy because often we need to laugh to carry on, just to get through it. In her memoir and essay, she shows us how, and how to look good doing it.
You ready? Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
So I'm going to read a scene from an essay called Attic Bats, Modern Love. It's about when I found a dead bat at the bottom of my bookcase and then Googled myself into thinking I had contracted rabies, which got me thinking about, like, the afterlife and if I'm being nice enough. So this is just me falling asleep after all that had happened during the day. Okay. Everything I'd read online confirmed it was too soon to tell if I had it. With rabies, you can go months without showing any signs, and the symptoms don't really matter anyway. By the time you show any, you're already a guaranteed goner. While lying in bed that night, I imagined trapdoors opening from the ceiling and bats pouring out. I pictured them whipping around my coat rack and stabbing my toes through our lavender top sheets. I think, if I die of rabies, I'll tell Abe to put "The Sleep of Reason Produces Monster" on the cover of my funeral pamphlet. That will be a class move. I turn to Abe. He sleeps like a loaf of uncooked sourdough. He won the most caring award in fifth grade, which is to say he's more considerate than I am. His mind has always been a populated place. I'm still internalizing the idea that the earth is covered with other people. Earlier, Abe pointed out that all things considered, being crushed by an enormous antique journal is not an awful way to die. It's very Terry Tempest Williams. It strikes me how bizarre it is that Abe put thought to that, how much pain was involved in the bat's death. That's why he's nice and asleep. I think about how much weight I'll lose if I get rabies. That's why I'm mean and awake. When I ask Abe what he thinks will happen after a person dies, his answer is that the person begins rotting. And the grossest part of that is that it's true. But my boyfriend takes a different thought on the rotting than I do. My body will no longer be important to me after I die. I'll be finished with it. Who knows what's next, but my body's done, and it will be going away now. I still can't wrap my head around the idea of consciousness without a body. Death is just how the body breaks, but I'm really attached to mine now, and it's not very Buddhist of me. Maybe this body is holding something eternal that will keep living after I die. I don't know, but I hope so. I don't know, but I'm not banking on it. I left bed to get a drink of water. Our tap water has the same aftertaste as Benadryl. This is because we have tons of discarded mountain tips lying around West Virginia. I picture their particles making my water muggy. Brita filters work, I write down in my journal when I get back to bed. My flashlight wakes up Abe. Bodies are inferior, and that's the worst because I love mine. It's grown on me with its constellation of freckles across the stomach. My rib cage takes its job so seriously, never lets anything poke my lungs or my heart. And my legs and heart are always doing something, so I try to pay attention to them and learn about consistency. It feels wrong to tell my body it's not as holy as my soul. Why does it have to rot while the rust rises to do something new? I don't want to have rabies, I said to Aaron. I hadn't realized I was on the verge of crying until after I heard the quality of my voice escaping me. I tucked my head into his neck. I felt safer. I was an ostrich hiding from predators. Come here, you're fine. I loved his voice when it was deep and half asleep. You're not going to die till you finish paying off your student loans. He spun his hair with my fingers. I whispered to him what I wanted the title of my funeral pamphlet to be, and I whispered to him which friends I wanted to have which scarves if I die. And don't give the gold one to from Switzerland to anybody. Just destroy it in a theatrical way, I ended, before realizing he had already gone back to sleep. He makes being kind look so appealing. I tried to mimic his breathing, the way he holds his hands. I could do that, I thought. Thank you.
Jessica Guzman's thesis is entitled Adelante, a complex and beautiful sounding word that perfectly captures the urgent loveliness and brave onward of her poems. For most of us, honesty is no small project, but Jessica's work is a testament to its payoffs. Her poems, she says, strive to balance opening against the fear of openness. Again and again, Jessica wills herself to find and enter some place of breaching, some unstitched seam. The struggle, I'd say, is the beauty. One undercurrent, says Jessica, is the divine. The poems you'll see offer handholds any one of us might need. Please welcome Jessica Guzman.
Thank you, everybody. This is much lighter than I thought it would be. I don't know why I thought it was going to be very heavy. So I'll just read a few poems from my thesis. This first is called Allegory of a Beached Whale. The Achaeans feared dying first, and so stand you on the jetty's prow, no shield to jump to. Look now, the water's just hip deep, the wrinkles in your cheeks reflection. The wake washes your feet graciously. But solitude follows an only son. This is what you don't need, a crumpled cigarette and speed dial, the dead and living on an answering machine. Even as the horizon splits, threatens to sunder the earth, the sun thrusts to sea. The joke is specificity, all those soldiers and their horses and their hoplons, a while of splendor, and this whale fall, half devoured, gulls and green flies making rounds from the body to the ocean, the shore red sweatered now, like a pomegranate crushed under your heel. The next poem is called Florida History, and I wrote it using different sentences I found in my middle school and high school history notebook. There are too many beginnings and no point. We could say the scarf was knit with one spool. Sooner or later, someone will unravel it just to know. Just as well, we start with the big words. But the peninsula stood unsurrendered, I wrote in eighth grade. And she laid down her arms in ninth. A paraphrase, then, the man's boat was a 57 Corvette. We could have all the catheads to house our anchors and all the lighthouses to match, while the cities continue to flood. Under the jacaranda, it is easiest to notice something small and scrawled in a corner. The baby, the baby, the baby, the bay. And the last poem I'm going to read is Washing the Tub at 2 a.m. for my father. Thrush and a swirl, the dove bone dirt from my shoulders brushed, russet from the heart, the old priest ground with the body between preludes. Little warning, the batter browns the grout. Believe the neck snaps fast. I saw it once, bird placid on the palm as Snow White's helpers. Then thrown in a pot, thrown on the hearth. Quicker than vinegar, but Lord, the smell, bleach burning my hangnails. Though I never called you, not once, to recall the prayer whispered over me when I was small and scared of ghosts. I spilt no milk those evenings or this one, and by myself hear the ambulance horn blare on the empty street. Notice we have the same hands. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Okay. It is not every day, as a teacher, that one is CC'd on an email, sender named Administrator of West Virginia University, with the following subject heading. If they are holy, they are pinned to it like a spear through a boar, has been accepted. This was the email I got, precisely in those words, along with John Bryant, its recipient, last week when John's aforementioned thesis was confirmed as meeting something called ETD approval. Neither is it every day as a teacher that one signs such an ETD, or maybe it's EDT now that I look at it, I'm not sure, approval form on the sidelines of a basketball court, which I had done the week prior, soiling it with my forehead sweat as I came off a hard-fought loss in a pickup game at the rec center. John, or Jables as I like to call him,
having nobly done everything he could to destroy his foe. At the end of every spring semester, those of us who direct MFA theses get to send out a congratulatory email when our student has successfully defended their work. And I can tell you that it certainly is not every day, as I've already said twice, that I get to, in performing this task, use such words as these, which I emailed to the entire department on March 30th. This morning at 9 o'clock, John Bryant radiated brightly in a bold luminescence as he successfully defended his thesis, a collection of short stories entitled, If They Are Holy, They Are Pinned to It Like a Spear Through a Boar. I stand by what I went on to say in that email, that John's work is highly original and utterly memorable. His sentences are the real thing. Flannery O'Connor would be very proud of him. Of his kind of writer, she said this: the problem for such a writer will be to know how far he can distort without destroying, and in order not to destroy, he will have to descend far enough into himself to reach those underground springs that give life to his work. This descent into himself will, at the same time, be a descent into his region. It will be a descent through the darkness of the familiar into a world where, like the blind man cured in the Gospels, he sees men as if they were trees, but walking. John has made the descent, and he is among the trees, and it isn't only because he's so damn tall that he sees all that he does. He's worked hard to put across that kind of vision. I give you Jables, John Bryant.
Hey, can everyone hear me? All right. I don't know if real quick, I just want to thank my MFA daddy, Glenn, over here. Our relationship is, he's always made it, made me know from the beginning that our relationship was going to be informal, and that really helped. And I also want to thank all of my wife, because she changed my heart when it needed changing, and my pastor, who taught me there's nothing that it is the same as grace, and that was a big thing to learn. Okay, this is a story about an 80-year-old father who every day goes to visit his 60-year-old son, who is in a nursing home after years of drug abuse, and sort of is his sort of caregiver, takes him on walks and stuff. So we start there. Are you sure you can hear me? I've been nervous about that. He sat in a chair with no armrest, so he crossed his legs and hung one big hand and the other on top of his knee. He watched his son spilled onto his side, then saw his son curve his own body so it took the form of a pose, the shape of what was beautiful and predestined rather than what had to be wiped. The nurses gave themselves to him with their hands and with the time there was left before they could stand up and smoke outside, and the father saw them bent over the pull and distortion of their bodies and knew they were tired of what it meant and would mean to keep him breathing in sheets. His son never ate. He refused. The nurses left into the sound of other things in other rooms. He pulled the chair close to his son, held his breath so the quiet in him was the quiet in the room, and when he breathed out, the room was small and he could feel the walls on his neck and back. They both, without even the motion of eyes, acknowledged the father was sitting in a chair and the son was lying in bed, and that was what things were. He pulled a book from his pocket and let his son sleep. He wasn't working through it. He liked to read at the place the book fell open. Sleep opened his son's mouth by a soft inch, and breath followed itself in and out of what was left of his body. The father felt his son's old, tired hand on his knee because he had been asleep as well, and it meant that they could go now. Now they could go. The father found a pair of pants in the drawer, fished out the sock that was the same as the brown one in his hand. He pulled the pants over his son's legs, one at a time, pulling hard when they got caught on knees or ankles. He took several breaks that did not embarrass him or his son, but only made them more gentle with where they looked. The father stood up to let his body become itself and thought of nothing, no idea that would declare itself to him, then went down to the small brown shoe, half on, half off his son's foot. He looked at his son. His hair was not what it should be. He took the hair into his hands and dressed him in the image of what could be loved and taken seriously. The father had been there 10 years ago after an overdose, when his son had too much of drugs and everything in his arms, when nurses hooked him up to an IV, and his son, his jaw open, eyes to the side, told them what he knew about men and women and bars. And the father listened, and the nurses listened, but the father knew, he saw the nurses and knew, that his son's words said less about life, the life of men and women, and more about the insane way he looked, his lack of sleep, his nervous way. They hushed him a little. They didn't know how rarely he spoke. If he got tired dressing his son, he remembered there was nothing the time they had left was supposed to mean. There was just a walk it would be nice to go on. And he waited until there was tenderness and something near elegance in the move of his arms and the way he dressed him. He signed his son out with a pen already in his pocket. His hand on the end of the wheelchair made it easier to believe they would get somewhere eventually. He was their only son. He was smart, and the father always took a bit of awe with him growing up. Watched him when he moved or ran or lifted branches or walked out the door, or when he did something new like catch a pass. He was a natural. The world balanced itself on him. Whatever new thing he did, he would soon find himself by a miracle doing it the only way it should be done. And the father looked on him as having been touched on the head and shoulders by something that was neither his nor his wife's to give. The son never spoke. The father never asked him what he was thinking growing up, what all the silence was for. But he did once, after a baseball game, his son with a glove in his hand, not eating his popsicle and letting it melt. He asked him why he wasn't happier, and the son turned to him, and something in the room and in his son was lost by his asking. His son left when he was old enough to. He would visit them, sit on their chair, eat slowly and hardly eat, just let the steam on the lasagna rise to the new look on his face. He was quiet. But they knew when he was gone that he was wild and quiet, ran with wild women, operated on himself with the pleasures of this world, and lit his body into a flame. He came back to their house on the highway every now and then, came back to them thinner, with different clothes, his skin a new texture, a new angle of the face he tilted at them. It made the father suffer to see him so thin and confident. He couldn't understand it. The son came back to them year after year, backpack in the palm of his hand, holes in jeans, came back thinner and thinner and more graceful, like the world had found a way to balance perfectly on him and his choices. As his body wasted and drew closer to itself, he seemed to be more considerate and holy and artful with what was left, knew more about how to dress and walk and hold his mother's hand. He had a way of putting a cup on the table that would almost make the father cry. And when he came back, years and years at a time, it seemed he knew so much more about what he would never tell them. And the father would sit and look at his son long after his wife had gone to bed and long after she died, and waited for his son to speak. He felt if his son spoke that he would nod in surprise and agreement, and there would finally be a way for the two of them working together. There would finally be a way the two of them working together would never be wrong again. The father sold his house and moved when his son was in intensive care. He ate oranges with his friend at the park and walked to the hospital to see his son and to say nothing and to take him on walks. The father felt, after all these years, a respect for the quiet that had become their way with each other. He felt, after so many hours sitting and watching and looking, that it was a way of honoring what each had found in this world for himself. There was a bump in the road as he pushed. The son forgave him by the slight lifting of a hand. He studied his breath and his son's. They should die around the same time. And since death was so close to both of them, there was nothing much to say about it. "I'm going to church," the son said, his head pulled to the side as if to talk to his own shoulder. "I'll take you," the father said. He made sure to push and to listen, but he suffered. His son, by turning to Jesus, had broken the agreement that they would die without having much to say. And it hurt in a simpler way than that, that they would not, when they were dead and could not be found in their breath, agree to meet somewhere and be quiet.
That was very nice, wasn't it? And the actual reading part, too, like the reading skills, that was one of our best readings, I think. Thank you all so much. And thank you all for coming and please eat those flying WB cookies that we probably paid a fortune for. And, of course, we want to get a picture of all of our graduating MFA, so if you could stand someplace pretty, that would be good. Thank you.